This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Slovakia says it will vote again to back the Eurozone's new bailout fund after a vote Tuesday failed in Bratislava. Slovak Parliament says it has reached agreement and will approve the fund by the end of the week. But Tuesday's vote did claim one victim, the Slovak government. A vote of confidence was attached to the fund's approval, and now Slovakia is in political disarray. Our correspondent Rob Cameron reports.
This was the moment that Slovakia said no to beefing up the European Financial Stability Facility, the last of the Eurozone's 17 members to vote on measures to protect Europe from the sovereign debt crisis. It was also the moment, after a tense, emotional day in Parliament, that Iveta Radičová's four-party coalition collapsed after just 15 months in the job. Mrs. Radičová had made the fateful decision to attach a confidence vote to the bill ratifying the bolstered bailout fund in a last-ditch effort to budge her recalcitrant coalition ally, the Freedom and Solidarity Party. Shortly after the vote, she appeared before reporters, still red-eyed and emotional from Slovakia's rejection of the proposal, despite her urgings that it was in her country's interests to show solidarity with its Eurozone partners.
Just let me pose one little question. Are we really saying that 17 Eurozone governments are idiots? Are we really saying that 16 Eurozone parliaments are fools? Are we really saying they don't know that the steps prepared are the only possible steps to at least slow down the effects of the crisis on our citizens?
Premier Radičová is now waiting for the return of the country's president, who's cutting short his official visit to the Far East, so she can formally submit her resignation. Meanwhile, the three parties of the coalition who do support the EFSF are in talks with the left-wing opposition Smer Party, who've promised to help ratify the bill in a second vote in Parliament. Now they've achieved their primary goal of bringing down the government. Freedom and Solidarity leader Richard Sulík, who failed to drop his opposition to the bailout fund despite huge pressure both at home and abroad, also addressed journalists on Tuesday evening. Sulík has said it's simply immoral for the taxpayers of a relatively poor and fiscally responsible country like Slovakia to bail out fiscally lazy countries like Greece, which should, he says, be allowed to go bankrupt. He told reporters he didn't believe the outcome of a second vote on the bailout fund, which could be held as early as Thursday, was a foregone conclusion.
I don't see the second vote as a total certainty. I hope people don't expect Slovakia to keep voting until they produce the result that Brussels wants. Slovakia is a sovereign country and the Slovak parliament is a sovereign institution. It voted clearly yesterday, so why should it vote again? It reminds me a bit of Ireland, where they had to keep having referendums until they produced the result that Brussels wanted.
Analysts, however, say Slovakia is under so much pressure to ratify, it will vote yes second time around. Europe's leaders, they believe, care little about Slovak domestic stability. The priority is saving the Eurozone from disaster. Indeed, the markets appeared fairly unruffled by the no vote, either because they were expecting it or, as some claim, they already realise that even enlarging the fund to 440 billion euros is no longer enough. Rob Cameron, Deutsche Welle Radio, Prague.
The Eurozone crisis is being felt everywhere in Europe. But in Britain, it has led to calls for a referendum on whether the country should leave the European Union. A loud chorus of Euroscepticism has emerged among right-wing thinkers and politicians who believe the euro has always been doomed as a currency. They even say Britain would be better off without the EU. Ali Barrett reports from London.
Ever since the inception of the European Union, it was predicted by some on the right in Britain that the dream of a single currency would become a nightmare. And now with the Eurozone in crisis, prominent Conservatives here are trying not to actually say, "I told you so." They are pointing out, though they predicted this, Sajid Javid MP is among those who insist it was inevitable.
When the currency was created, It was a monetary union without fiscal union. And there's never been a currency union in history where you've managed to achieve it without fiscal union. And the problem is, I actually believe that European leaders at the time knew this. They knew it wouldn't work without a system of tax transfers where rich regions could subsidize poor regions. But they ignored it. And the reason they ignored it is, had they actually created a single treasury, then it would have led to a massive loss of sovereignty.
British banks look set to weather this storm better than some of their Eurozone counterparts because this country never entered the single currency. And many finance experts here, including Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, are now convinced the entire Euro project is doomed.
What seems to me reasonably clear is that as the Eurozone is today, as it's structured now, it can't easily survive.
But even with a group of right-wing Conservative MPs calling loudly for a referendum on Britain's EU membership, the coalition government, which contains the pro-Europe Liberal Democrats, is resisting calls to put the matter to the public. That's the right move, says economist Simon Tilford from the pro-EU Centre for European Reform.
I don't think the time is right to be raising issues of membership. I think that would be interpreted, rightly or wrongly, as a rather unhelpful, even aggressive move.
But even pro-Europeans in the UK are admitting the European project and the single currency need huge reform if they're to survive.
Given the current policies and the lack of appropriate institutions at Eurozone level, no, it can't work. So if they continue to try and address the crisis in the way they are, i.e. if they continue to argue that it's possible to have a currency union held together by rules rather than institutions, then it can't work, and the Eurosceptics in the UK are actually right to draw attention to that.
And British politicians on the right are increasingly dubious about what the UK gets out of its EU membership. With the UK economy stalling, some insist the huge funds which go to Brussels each year would be better spent here. Sajid Javid MP says once the Eurozone crisis is dealt with, Britons do want to reassess the country's ties with the European Union.
There's an overwhelming majority of British people think that the powers that we've given away to Europe have gone too far. At the same time, I think many of them respect that we need to work together to have free trade and to break down trade barriers, and that's very important.
The coalition government maintains it is committed to membership of the European Union and that Britain is better off attempting to reform it from within than by leaving. So while the increasingly loud chorus for a referendum on Europe is not likely to be answered soon, once the Eurozone crisis passes, Brussels can expect Britain to be asking some searching questions about the future of its relationship with the EU. Ollie Barrett, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
For more news and information from the heart of Europe, visit our website, dwworld.de. There you will find the latest news updates, as well as podcasts of many Deutsche Welle radio programs. With a uniquely European perspective on the events of the day, you're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio Newslink from Bonn, Germany.
Three more attempted arson attacks have been averted in Berlin after rail workers found explosive devices near train tracks on Wednesday, preventing them from detonating. This brings the number of attempted attacks in and around the German capital this week to around a dozen. So far, only one attack has succeeded, but the series has unleashed a fierce debate about the threat of left-wing terrorism in Berlin, as Uwe Hessler reports.
Since Monday, the unearthing of ever more explosive devices have temporarily brought train traffic to a halt in Berlin, causing major delays and angry reactions from passengers. The makeshift bombs are usually made from plastic bottles filled with an explosive liquid. In most cases, they were planted in utility shafts near railway tracks and meant to set signal cables on fire. That is why passengers in the German capital are not overly afraid of them.
I'm not worried.
I don't have fear, no.
I've heard of it, but I'm not scared now.
That's life in this century.
For almost a year now, left-wing radicals have been setting luxury cars on fire and throwing paint bombs at bank buildings and administrative offices. The new series of railway arson attacks is apparently the work of a group calling itself Hekla Reception Committee, named after an Icelandic volcano. They claimed responsibility for the attacks, saying in a statement published on the internet that they were in response to Germany's participation in the war in Afghanistan. They say they want to bring the German capital to a standstill. Christian Steyhoff from the Criminal Police Agency in Berlin says the new attacks are different because they require more organization and preparation.
Ein anderes Niveau haben wir hier mit Sicherheit.
These attacks mark a new level of crime that cannot be compared with the arson attacks on luxury cars we've seen so far, he says. We suspect them to be carried out by more radical activists in the left-wing scene. German Transport Minister Peter Ramsauer also sees a new dimension in the attacks.
Die in eine auch neue Dimension hineingehen.
The new dimension lies in the fact that for the first time, crucial German transport infrastructure is affected, he says. In addition, huge numbers of people are threatened by possible railway accidents. Ramsauer is a member of the conservative Christian Democrats and has attacked Berlin's Social Democrat-led city government for not doing enough to combat left-wing extremism in the city. However, Thomas Kleineidam, domestic policy spokesman for Berlin Social Democrats, believes the threat of left-wing terrorism is overblown. I find it hard to see a political motive in the attacks, he says. The perpetrators are just sick people who want to dominate others. They appear to get their kicks from trying to bring the whole city to a standstill. Police in Berlin said on Wednesday that it was sheer luck that only one of the firebombs actually detonated. Heavy rainfall had prevented the others from going off, causing really major damage. But they expected more bombs to be found, the police said, as just a small section of an estimated 6,000 kilometers of railway tracks in and around Berlin had so far been searched. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Serbia has been recognized as an official candidate for European Union membership. Serbian President Boris Tadic said he was proud that the EU praised Belgrade's efforts in a report presented in Brussels on Wednesday. But the EU said real membership talks could only begin if further progress was made. I asked our Brussels correspondent Vanessa Mack what this means.
Well, it means that although Serbia has basically ticked all the boxes in terms of meeting the demands by the European membership, there is one huge block in the way, and that is its relations with neighbouring Kosovo, which is still a huge sticking point. Belgrade, as you know, lost control of Kosovo back in 1999, and ever since then there has been lots of tensions with the province. Belgrade has not recognised Kosovo's independence. And there have been all sorts of disputes between the two entities in the past months, which have really become a major issue for the EU. Lots of concern, and some European member states, including Germany, have said unless there is a resumption of talk with no preconditions, then there's absolutely no question of Serbia actually starting accession talks with the EU.
When could negotiations begin between Serbia and Kosovo?
They could theoretically start next week or the week after if this issue with Kosovo is resolved. But much more likely is that this will take very, very many months because, of course, even though the European Commission has now given the green light to formally starting the talks, providing that the tensions are smoothed out with Kosovo, this is still ultimately up to member states. And some of them are very unenthusiastic about the prospect of more countries waiting in the wings. We've got Croatia joining next year. There is a huge amount of enlargement fatigue. Member states, particularly the larger ones, are much more focused on what's happening, for instance, with the Eurozone, and think that the last thing right now that the bloc needs is a relatively poor country with all its own internal problems joining the Union at such a difficult time. So I think it's going to be a very long process, possibly not as long and drawn out as Turkey, but as long as the debt crisis is not brought under control, I think Serbia is going to be very much put on a back burner.
Apropos Turkey, which was also discussed on Wednesday in the progress report, there's a similar situation going on there with Cyprus. What did Brussels have to say about this?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern, really, at the ongoing... Well, at two things. First of all, at the fact that the talks, for all intents and purposes, have completely ground to a halt over the past year with Turkey, not just because of the Cyprus issue, but also because of opposition by some very important member states, France, Germany, Austria, which just don't want to see this very large Muslim nation join the EU, full stop, on ideological grounds. Then you've got the other issue, which is Cyprus, and there things have also taken really a turn for the worse. There's been this big spat between Cyprus and Turkey because of gas exploration. And in fact, Turkey, it seems, has been trying to apply military pressure to challenge Cyprus on these gas rights in the Mediterranean Sea. So that's not looking good at all. On the other hand, you have supporters of Turkish membership, which turn back to the EU and says, well, actually, it was the EU that made a big mistake in the first place in taking on, you know, the divided island of Cyprus back in 2004. That's what paved the way for all the problems. And now the whole dialogue with Turkey smacks of double standards. You know, one rule for Cyprus, one rule for Turkey. But there's very little prospect, I think, also in light of what is seen as some unfavourable political developments in Ankara, of any of the deadlocks really being resolved anytime soon with Turkey.
From the heart of Europe, this is Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Gabriel Borud. In Italy, the economic crisis is not just affecting the job market and family budgets. It's also profoundly altering the country's landscape and agriculture. That has conservationists around the country worried and calling for a halt to what they say is the selling off of what makes Italy unique in Europe. Megan Williams now with this report from Rome.
Italy is known all over the world for its wonderful landscapes and delicious produce. Millions of tourists visit each year for those reasons alone, to relax on a hillside village over a plate of locally grown food and a bottle of wine. But Italy's wealth in the form of its agricultural lands has been slowly eroding, a process that is accelerating as fear of the economic future sets in. In the past decade, Italy has lost a third of its farmland to development, 3 million hectares of fertile land paved over. It's a situation that Alessandra Mottola Molfino, head of the conservation group Italia Nostra, once halted.
The government is exploiting Italy at the maximum, selling objects, selling land, selling buildings, historical buildings, all the heritage that we have got, which is on the other side, the real richness of our country. We cannot waste this richness.
Mottola Molfino says instead of investing in environmentally sustainable development and culture, the government has taken the short-sighted approach of big construction projects. That is, when it's not selling off precious resources like arable land. Indeed, recently, Italy's Minister of Innovation proposed this solution to Italy's crippling debt. Sell, said Minister Brunetta. We need to sell all the dead capital that unfortunately still exists in our country. From public assets to buildings to houses, sell everything that doesn't bring in money and that isn't strategic. Chisito Prunelli is the head of Italia Nostra in the area southeast of Milan. There, a major highway and developments threaten a huge tract of farmland that until now has served as a green reprieve for the polluted city. He says while towns themselves would like to protect land, allowing construction is often the only way they have to raise revenue.
I comuni non hanno più risorse per mantenere i servizi.
Towns don't have money anymore, so they hand out permits allowing people to build houses and shopping centers. Property tax is their only revenue to cover the cost of services because the government cut local funding. This is what fuels all the development.
Logistiche, capannoni, eccetera, che sono quelle che rendono più soldi alle casse comunali.
Despite the threat to farmland, Alessandra Mottola Molfino says interest in local products and the rural lifestyle is actually rising in Italy. Italians are buying more locally grown products, and more younger people are taking over farms. What's missing is a government policy that supports those trends.
Because we have the most fertile soil in the world, and the plains and the hills and the weather and the water. We have everything. We were named in the past centuries like the garden of Europe. So we must go back to that garden.
Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
In the current economic climate, it's rare enough when you can say that anything is booming. But there is one business that's doing exactly that, the internet. And now a school has opened in Paris dedicated entirely to training people up for jobs in the online sector. Our correspondent John Lawrenson has more.
The European School of Internet Professions, it's called, and it opened for its first term a few days ago inside the great neoclassical Parthenon in the middle of town, which used to house the French Stock Exchange. Cyril, 20, is one of the new students and likes what he's seen so far.
C'est impressionnant. La volonté de créer, on la sent.
It's very impressive, the will to create that you can feel here. And it's an extraordinary network of talent. I've only been here a week, but I've already met Nicolas, who's a designer, Maxime and Mathieu, who are very good developers. I work more in the financial sphere for the time being myself, but there are all possible work profiles here. Everything you need to start a company that could turn out to be the new Facebook. For the moment, there are 142 students, which they plan to increase to 250, each of whom pays 6,500 euros a year during 3 years of study. They learn professions like web designer, developer, e-marketeer, or traffic manager. And if most of us haven't a clue what people with such job titles might actually do, that's a pity for us because these skills have become highly saleable. So says Gauthier Picard, founder and CEO of an e-commerce site called Rue du Commerce, which employs 280 people.
Par définition, sur l'internet, on agit très vite, c'est-à-dire que
things move quickly in this business, says Picard, and we recruit as soon as new demand comes up. But even then, there's a delay because it usually takes 6 months to train the recruit. What's good about a school that's 100% dedicated to the net is that it should supply professionals who are going to be operational straight away. And the recruitment needs of web-based businesses are already outstripping supply. Marc Simoncini is the founder of a highly successful French internet dating site called Mythique and co-founder of this school. He says it's already very difficult for firms such as his to recruit the talent they need. There are profiles which are very hard to find, says Simoncini. The worst is computer programmer. We have to go and find them in Romania, while the Romanians go and find them in Vietnam. Finding people who are good among the people who are trained for the job is even more difficult. There are many people in the sector who have a lot of talent, but who think being more or less okay is good enough. The internet isn't just guys in cool training shoes who get out of bed at midday. It's hard work and discipline. I'm telling these students that if they get up a quarter of an hour earlier than their mates and manage to be a little less, more or less, they'll make it in their professional lives. Simoncini says he and the other founders intend to open a second web school in Marseille. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
This is Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm your host, Gabriel Borud. You're listening to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Gabriel Borud. Coming up on the program, we meet a young Serbian who's fighting for human rights, a Kurdish-Dutch composer who's traveled worlds in search of recognition, and a 27-year-old writer from Berlin who's just won a prestigious German book prize. We'll have all those reports and more, but first, celebrations have erupted in Gaza and Jerusalem after Israel and Hamas announced that Gilad Shalit, a captive Israeli soldier, would be freed in a prisoner swap. Under the deal, Hamas will free Shalit in return for the release of around 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, some of whom were involved in suicide attacks. As Iris Makler reports from Jerusalem, the pending release of these prisoners had been an obstacle to Shalit's freedom for over 5 years.
Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, announcing the unprecedented prisoner swap late Tuesday night. In a nationally televised address, he said it was the best deal Israel could get. I don't think we'd have reached a better deal if we'd waited, says Netanyahu. And there was a real chance that this window of opportunity might have closed and we'd have no deal at all. Israel has never exchanged so many prisoners for one soldier. 1,000 Palestinian prisoners will be released in two tranches. The first 450 will be freed in a few days' time, in a direct swap for captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. The prisoners on this list were nominated by the Islamic group Hamas. They include militants who've taken part in or planned suicide attacks against Israeli civilians. Reaching agreement on these names was what took more than 5 years of negotiating between the two sides. Hundreds of Israelis gathered in the centre of Jerusalem after the announcement. 17-year-old high school student Emanuela Cohen says this is one of the happiest days of her life, although she doesn't know Gilad Shalit personally.
We're here, we're dancing, we're hugging each other, and it's amazing. It's like a holiday for us.
Psychology student Emuna Ben Yashar agrees.
It's a really exciting and happy day for all of us. It's like the heart of everybody is in the same place.
There were also celebrations on the streets of Gaza City, with soldiers handing out sweets and firing into the air. Hamas leaders waved to cheering crowds. In Damascus, exiled political leader Khaled Mashal gave a speech broadcast on the Hamas satellite TV channel. He described the historic deal as a national achievement for Palestinians and said the prisoners to be released included all 27 women being held in Israeli jails. The prisoners come from Gaza, from the West Bank, from East Jerusalem, and include Arabs who live inside Israel, he said. This geography tells the story. Our suffering is one suffering, and our obligation is one obligation. The Israeli public broadly supports paying this price to return Gilad Shalit, but the uneven terms of this swap do arouse some opposition inside Israel. Opponents worry about two main risks. First, that the prisoners Israel is to release will simply return to their previous militant activity and carry out further suicide attacks. Second, that this release will encourage more kidnappings of Israeli soldiers. Iris Makler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Jerusalem.
News and information from a European perspective. You're listening to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio. Britain was shocked recently when a case came to light involving 24 victims of modern-day slavery. Perhaps the biggest surprise was that many of the alleged victims were British. In an age of economic downturn, homeless charities and rights groups are worried that more and more vulnerable people are being forced to work against their will. Nick Martin reports from London.
It seems the victims of people trafficking are changing somewhat. Anti-slavery campaigners say they've noticed in some cases gangs don't need to bring in their victims from abroad anymore. Homeless charities say adequate numbers of foreigners are now living rough on the streets of the UK, that they may constitute a new market ripe for exploitation. Although it's not widespread, the most recent case of alleged modern slavery has highlighted how men from Eastern Europe, the Middle East and West Africa were approached at soup kitchens, night shelters and job centres. As they're not always entitled to welfare, most men don't hesitate when someone offers them the chance of regular work and accommodation. Adam Rees is head of street and community outreach for St Mungo's homeless charity.
The people who are approached are generally people who have no family connections, little to live for. You know, they've lost work or they haven't been able to find work. People who are alcohol dependent, people who are mentally unwell. The vulnerable people, really, essentially, who haven't got the wherewithal or the strength to say no. It's appealing for someone to come up and say, let's go, I can offer you a job, I can offer you accommodation. People are financially or economically vulnerable as well.
Much of the work is in the construction and road building industries or in the agricultural sector. But despite reasonable promises, often salaries are never paid, accommodation is cramped and dirty, and any food is very basic. In one case, some of the victims were allegedly kept in kennels. Rights campaigners claim this latest raid on a traveller's site in the county of Bedfordshire has highlighted an underreported problem. There were allegedly 15 British victims of slavery. Many of them are said to be alcoholics or those with mental health issues who have spent recent years in crisis. It's alleged that some had been kept in servitude for up to 15 years and in conditions described as squalid. Clara Skrivankova is from Anti-Slavery International.
It's not something new or unusual, but still in the public perception it seems quite uncommon. And at the same time, the government also doesn't seem to want to pay attention to the fact that also nationals of their own country can become victims of trafficking and seems to highlight the issue of international trafficking rather than the fact that it can happen internally. No borders have to be crossed. And people who might be particularly vulnerable because of their age, social situation or poverty can easily become victims of trafficking or forced labour within the UK.
Britain is not alone in seeing increased cases of modern slavery. Just last month, French newspapers lamented the cruel treatment of temporary workers responsible for harvesting the champagne grapes. And in the Netherlands, a farmer stands accused of human trafficking and labour exploitation after workers alleged they had their passports confiscated, were refused permission to leave, and were paid far below the minimum wage. EU ministers issued a new directive earlier this year, calling on all countries to do more to prevent and combat human trafficking. Figures suggest that more than 14,000 victims were uncovered in EU countries during 2009. Britain enacted the new Slavery and Servitude Act last year to give police additional powers to prosecute those suspected of enforced labour. In theory, prison sentences were toughened, but campaigners say in practice, very little has changed.
Most of the sentences we see either for forced labour or trafficking are not more than 2 years. Some sentences are suspended, some sentences would tend to be around 6 months. And I think that still reflects the fact that slavery is not considered as a serious crime, despite the fact that it actually is a serious crime that can carry a sentence of up to 14 years. And that's something we've been highlighting as well, that actually the Crown Prosecution Service should either appeal against sentences or try to issue further guidance in terms of what should be the appropriate sentence for cases of trafficking and slavery.
Anti-Slavery International say they're sometimes the first port of call for those trying to escape forced labour. And homeless charities like St Mungo say they keep strong relationships with those sleeping rough. Adam Rees again.
We have teams that work with people who live on the streets. The people that come back to us tell us that they were held against their will, they were threatened with violence if they left, they were threatened with that people knew their families or would be able to get to them. One instance I hear of is someone was held for 9 years and when they escaped they didn't really know where they were and they just wandered around for a long time in the countryside in the UK and then hitched back to London.
To keep the issue in perspective, recent UK figures suggest that sexual exploitation is still the major factor in half of suspected trafficking cases, and women made up more than three quarters of the victims. But the most recent incident has shown how vulnerable people of all backgrounds can be preyed on by those wanting to profit from their hard work. Nick Martin, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
And the active support for issues such as democratic values and human rights form an integral part of German foreign policy. But how does that work when Berlin has to deal with leaders in countries that do not share those same values? The way Germany handles the autocratic rulers of this world is a subject of regular debate inside and outside the government. Greg Benzo reports.
In February of this year, the German government briefly considered taking in deposed Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak. There was also considerable debate on how to deal with members of Libya's Gaddafi clan. On numerous occasions, German foreign ministers have been chided during state visits for being too close to autocratic rulers. So what criteria are there for handling the despotic rulers of this world? Before every visit with a controversial political figure, the German foreign ministry discusses how long the handshake should be, whether or not the minister should sit on the same couch or be photographed together. Should there be a joint dinner, and so on. It's a constant and delicate balance between dialogue and distance, between national interests and human rights. Carsten Müller of the opposition Green Party was an undersecretary in the German Foreign Ministry between 2002 and 2005. She criticizes that too often Western interests prevailed in the contacts with leaders like Egypt's Mubarak or Tunisia's President Ben Ali.
Das war falsch.
That was wrong. It was a fatal mistake. We confused stability with stagnation and indirectly propped up these despots.
However, Germany needs to maintain a dialogue with undemocratic countries, argues Joachim Hörster, who is on the Foreign Affairs Committee of Parliament and is a member of the governing Christian Democrats.
It is our job to promote our model in international affairs and to ensure that in a democracy, individual rights and political freedoms play a significant role. We need to make clear that in return, that also means growth in the respective country. If we wish to convey our standards in exemplary fashion, then we have to be flexible, while at the same time demanding from our partners in undemocratic countries that they alter their situations.
Like Joachim Hörster, a majority of German foreign policy specialists operate under the motto, change through rapprochement. In other words, only closer contacts can bring change to countries with democracy deficits. Opposition parties in Germany have criticized Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle for sitting on the same sofa as Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, or for calling Egypt's Mubarak a wise friend of Germany's. The political stumbling blocks are many and often lie in tiny gestures. That's why German diplomacy frequently tries to signal distance to despots with small measures. Schedules are constructed to avoid joint dinners, or negotiations are conducted longer at the working level to sidestep talks with government ministers. But it's also difficult to broach the topic of human rights with dictatorial regimes, says Bihan Jirsarai of Westerwelle's Free Democratic Party.
I personally experienced a situation in which my dialogue partner was totally offended, saying I had exaggerated and didn't know anything about the realities in his country anyway, and didn't understand the cultural background. But for me, that played no role at all. I wanted to talk about the subject, and I viewed it as my job to do so.
There are no handbooks or guidelines, and much depends on the situation. But the thrust of German foreign policy is to stick to its guns and not submit to every demand from autocratic rulers. Greg Benzo, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Deutsche Welle, from the heart of Europe.
Unlike most teenagers, 13-year-old Belgrade native Rastko Pocesta is concerned for the direction his nation is taking. So much so that he's devoted himself to commenting on political affairs in Serbia and fighting for human rights. Rastko is seen as a young leader and active social democrat in his community, doing his best to raise awareness and create a more open Serbia. Melanie Savchenko tells his inspiring story in this report.
While most young teens are playing sports and hanging out with friends, one 13-year-old in the Serbian capital of Belgrade has found a more productive way to spend his time.
My name is Rastko Pocesta and I'm 13 years old. I'm a human rights defender from Serbia.
But studying isn't Rasko's first priority.
I'm not really that active in school, you know. I got more focused on my activism, you know, in the field of human rights and political commentary.
It might be more reasonable to say that Rasko is a disciple of democracy, who looks up to role models like Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, and Julian Assange. In his quaint ground-floor flat in Belgrade, which he shares with his lawyer mother, Rastko sits stoically in front of his bookshelf, across from a small, neatly made bed. With his long brown hair, suit coat, and collared shirt, Raska looks more like a professor of philosophy than a kid who has just reached his teenage years.
Well, I got interested in politics a few years ago, and I started political commentary on the internet mostly, and later I also got involved in human rights activism.
His blog is called Heimatlos, a nod to Friedrich Nietzsche's concepts of homelessness. With lengthy entries added every few days, Raska reaches a wide readership of activists in Belgrade and beyond.
We are in the information age, and there are much easier and better ways to share your views, to share your thoughts and so on, and I think that blogging is a great way to do so. There are many supporters and there are many threats and so on.
As an outspoken 13-year-old in a politically turbulent Serbia, Raska has received violent threats for his social democratic views in a country teeming with nationalism.
I have a very strong anti-nationalist sentiment, and that's why some far-right groups actually threatened me.
Written in perfect English, Raska's blog reads more like a manifesto than a boy's journal, with recent entries including commentaries about the London riots and the anniversaries of 9/11, the Prague Spring, and Hiroshima.
I was concerned with Islamophobia, for example, in Europe, yes, and with the rise of the far right in recent years. The Arab Spring was a very interesting event for me, so I followed it and commented it on my blog.
He's also an advocate for a more open society in Serbia, one that accepts minorities and Kosovo's declaration of independence. At the moment, Raska is launching a human rights NGO called Civic Faction, along with his friend and colleague, Radovan Janadic.
I quickly realized that Raska is so ambitious person, very clever and brave to fight, and I believe that we will achieve all the goals in the future.
Since their first encounter, Raska has organized meetings in Belgrade for supporters of Julian Assange and the revolutionaries of Libya. Radovan admits he was already a fan of Raska's work before they met, as the young activists have been attracting quite a lot of attention, both negative and positive, during the past year.
Oh, it's good for us that young people thinking like this.
Yet being well-read and politically conscious at 13 does have its drawbacks when it comes to finding friends your own age.
You know, I really don't choose my friends by age.
Radovan Janadic agrees.
My opinion that age is not measure of maturity, wisdom, and of humanity. He's unique, of course, but I don't feel something different when I'm talking with my colleagues or my other friends. But he's like us.
I look to the stacks of books laying about on the desk and bedside table. Biographies of Julian Assange and Daniel Ellsberg mixed in with books of a young boy, fantasy and science fiction. So I can't help but wonder what kids his own age think of his work.
Of course, I did get support from people of my age. It's important for them to take part in society actively, because it's important for everyone to take part in society, and young people should be working for their future.
But motivating the youth culture of Serbia is not an easy job, due to decades of economic and social strife and persisting discrimination against minority groups.
I think that young people here can't understand what he's doing. Because most young people believe in nationalism here, and he's a fighter against nationalism. And all of us for thinking is in dangerous position, because we are minorities here, and we try to help our society to understand problems, to understand human rights without discrimination. And of course, it is very dangerous here. I said to him, no one can stop us or discourage us by threats.
Their dedication to their cause is evident, so it's not surprising that Raska wants to continue his work when he grows up.
I think that I'll continue with human rights activism, that's it. Probably I'll get associated with some organization more actively.
Melanie Savchenko, Deutsche Welle Radio, Belgrade.
From the heart of Europe, this is Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Gabriel Borud. 15 years ago, Kurdish-Dutch composer Ali Outman fled from political unrest in northern Iraq's Kurdistan. His journey was like that of thousands of immigrants who come to Europe in search of a better life. Outman presented his music to German audiences for the first time when the National Youth of Iraq Orchestra played one of his works at this year's Beethoven Fest. As Chipanda Chimbalu reports, it was music that accompanied this composer on his journey from war-torn Iraq to the Netherlands.
Mr. Redmond, we've heard reports from other UN officials that there has been heavy shelling in another city nearby, Sulaymaniyah. Can you confirm any news about that?
I cannot, because UNHCR does not have a presence in Sulaymaniyah at this time, so I cannot confirm that.
It's 1996, and two rival groups are fighting in northern Iraq's Kurdistan. At that time, composer and violist Ali Otman is 23 and among the thousands in the city of Sulaymaniyah fearing for their lives.
There was a very dangerous situation there. Especially for the young people, they want to learn something, make music, make art. There was nothing that time. After that, I decided to go, and my father was always against that. But at that moment, he gave us money to make a false passport and go to see our future.
In 1996, Ali left Iraq with his two brothers and a close friend. They crossed the border and traveled to Turkey like other thousands who had left Iraq before them. Having spent large amounts of money on their fake passports and travel, by the time they got to Istanbul, they had run out of cash.
We get a work in a chocolate fabric. That was a very hard work. All day we work there and we eat there and we stay for our sleep. We sleep there.
In Istanbul's industrial suburb, Büyükçekmece, Ali's life became focused on work, eat and sleep. After 7 months, the three brothers and their friend decided to face their next challenge of reaching Europe via Greece. They did this one at a time. Ali's brother and his friend failed. One of them was caught by the Greek soldiers and sent back to Iraq. But that didn't deter Ali from trying. He paid a smuggler 800 euros to take him in a truck.
We walked all the night when there's no light, and in the days we sleep. We must be very quiet, no moving, no do nothing. And it was 11 days, and from last day, 8 hours with the train to Athens.
Ali worked for 1 month in Greece to raise money. Then he took a ship to Italy and traveled by train to the Netherlands. Once he got to the Netherlands, he applied for asylum, and while waiting, he was placed in a detention camp. There, waiting was the biggest pastime, but a friend from Iraq brought him his viola.
Really, music has good role in my life there, because I had my viola to talk with it, and I listened to my feeling from the sound and from my inside. And that was very helpful. And sometimes another friends came to my room to listen.
Music was more than a source of comfort for Ali. It opened doors for him.
After 4 years, somebody said to me, you can go to conservatorium. And I'll try it to get some contact. And after that, we get a chance there in Holland. There's an organization called University Asylum Funds. They pay the study for you. If they see you are serious to study, they help you. And I get that chance.
In 2002, Ali started studying with Dutch composer Alex Manesson. He describes him as a teacher who allowed him to explore different styles. So Manesson helped Ali find himself. His musical philosophy is now heavily influenced by Dutch composer Ton de Leeuw.
What I make is interaction between East and West. Interaction between ingredients of something from West with some spicy from Kurdistan.
Ali has composed music for Amsterdam's Philharmonic. His latest work, Invocation, was played by the National Youth Orchestra of Iraq at this year's Beethovenfest.
My piece is about praying to avoid those differences and pray the God to let us live in freedom, in harmony.
Ali's composition, Invocation, is about voiding the differences between the various groups in Iraq. He believes music and art can change the world. Chiponda Chimbalu, Deutsche Welle Radio.
The search for artistic recognition is just as rife here in Germany, at least in the case of Antonia Baum. The 27-year-old writer has just won Germany's Ingeborg Bachmann Literature Prize for her first novel. The work shows that the age of the printed novel is not over.
My name is Antonia Baum. I live in Berlin. And it's not that I'm walking around and thinking, oh, I'm an author, I'm a writer. But it's a very important part of my life, writing. When you start to write, you think a lot about writing. How should I change my life and everything for writing and no boyfriend and all this and no fun, just writing, die for your art. But it's stupid. It's a cliche. And I don't know, I just write and I love it. I started writing when I was like 20 years old. And I think it was just because I didn't know what to do else. I can't sing, I can't paint beautiful pictures. Okay, I like dancing, but I'm not very good at it. It was just the only thing that I could do. And it's easy to do it because you have your computer and you can take it and just write. And I started to like it and I started to work at it. It was like this. And it was because I was sad, I think. and there were a lot of things that I had to think about. And so I discovered that it is a possibility to make something out of it like this. And why? I'm better in writing than talking. It's because I like the distance of time, which is between writing and somebody reads it and talking, which is right now. And when I'm talking right now, I'm talking a lot of stupid things. I mean, that's why I prefer writing. And for me, it's like battle rap. For me, writing is like fighting on the sheet of paper. Yeah. There I managed to find a forum to fight. Because normally I don't like fighting. I don't like fighting with my surroundings. I would say that I'm a very polite person. I don't like arguing or something like this. But on the sheet of paper, I love it. I came to this novel before I wrote short stories. The whole time I was trying to write a novel, but I didn't manage to write it because I always thought after reading it's a piece of shit and I threw it away. And that was the process. And while writing the novel, I also wrote a lot of short stories. And that was the process just. And then, I don't know, it was like 4 years during which I wrote terrible, disgusting novels and some good short stories. But then someday I threw all away and I started again. And then it was just 3 months and after it, the novel was ready. And it was, I knew what I wanted to tell or what I wanted to write, but I couldn't find the proper form. And then I found it and then it was easy and it flew. I would love to write some books, but I don't know if I'm able to, just if I can manage it to write another book. I would love to, because that's what I do, and that's what I love, yeah. But I don't know, it's difficult. I'm not happy when I think of the future concerning this money, blah, blah.
And that's a wrap for today's show. For more on those and other stories, feel free to visit our website at dw-world.de. Thanks for listening, and do tune in again at the same time tomorrow. For me, Gabriel Borud, and the rest of the Newslink team, goodbye.
Biggest book fair, the Frankfurt Book Fair, is taking place this month. Every year, the show throws the spotlight on one country with special readings and events. Who is it this time? Is it A, Canada, B, Iceland, or C, Vietnam? Send your answers to quiz.english@dw-world.de. Letters and postcards should be sent to Deutsche Welle, English Service 53110, Bonn, Germany. You have until the end of the month to send in your answers. Good luck!
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.